Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Politics is Personal, a conversation about faith in politics, where Catholic life mixes with politics, and how we ordinary people can get involved in politics, or should we at all, in fact. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by my co-host and resident lawyer, writer, political advisor, and she likes to be described as general rabble-rouser, Monica Dumit. Welcome, Monica.
In my defence, Peter, some of those rabbles really do need rousing from time to time.
Good point.
Good to be here.
And I'm joined today by Dominic Perrottet, member for Epping, is that correct?
That's right.
Treasurer of New South Wales. Welcome, Dominic.
Thanks, Peter.
Good to have you. Before we get started, we want to remind people that putting a review on iTunes helps us get out there and spread the word. This is a uniquely Australian Catholic podcast, and we think that's a good idea worth getting behind. If you write us a review, it helps people find us on iTunes and other things.
And you'll go to heaven.
This promise is not endorsed by This Catholic Life. Monica,
so however, a few indulgences.
Yes, Monica, however, does personally guarantee it. So there you go. Dom, how did you get started in politics? Let's start with that.
Oh, look, I always had an interest in public affairs, and growing up as a kid, we used to have pretty robust debates on issues around the kitchen table. And then when I went to university, I got involved in the Liberal Party and enjoyed getting in the debate at uni and the battle of ideas. And I always found it enjoyable. I liked debating and I liked getting involved in various things. And so that kind of set me down the path of pursuing politics.
Debate in university level is really where you cut your teeth in these kinds of things. Is there a difference, do you think, between public debate in university and the cutting thrust of debate and sort of student protests? Are they linked?
Well, I think it's come, I think they're linked to some extent, but I think we've come a long way. I mean, I was at university in 2001 to about 2005.
Right.
But back then, there was a much greater acceptance of the importance of political debate and free speech.
Right.
Whereas I think now, if you look at universities, which are meant to be the bastion of ideas, idea generation and free speech, it's become more about the protest and shutting down ideas. Right. And that's probably, I think, changed because more people from, I'd say, the left have probably won in a lot of areas of public policy and marching through the institutions. But that's why I always say it's ironic that this was the part, you know, the left of centre in politics were always the ones that had great ideas that would debate them, that would fight against the establishment. And now they've become the establishment shutting down those ideas on campus.
What's interesting to me is that some of the right now are making arguments for free speech and freedom of opinion. And it seems to be that argument seems to be made from the position of who are not dominating conversation.
But it wasn't that long ago where, I mean, I have a lot of friends in on the other side of politics, some of whom are in parliament today. But we always had a environment at Sydney University where debate and was common and we enjoyed it and was done in a respectful way. Unfortunately, I think that's changed over the last few years.
Maybe we can talk about that more. I don't think the average conversation has changed. It just seems to be what's the noise that's coming through and the airwave seems to have changed a lot more. Mm. Maybe it's because of what sells, but I'm being a bit cynical there. What inspired you to get specifically involved in politics? Like, so it's a big step to be, I mean, you're sure you get involved in policy discussions and uni, you may even be part of a political party, but to actually step up and be that front sort of candidate, that's a big decision.
Yeah, it was a big decision. And it was probably difficult in a way because I was working as a lawyer and I'd just got married. We'd had our first child, Charlotte, and I'd actually made the decision to move away. I was working as a lawyer, being involved in the organisation wing of the party, and I was probably finding it difficult to balance that with family, with my work. Mm-hmm. And so I had made the decision that I would actually pull back from politics. And then, you know, as it happened, the member at the time for Castle Hill, who'd been there for 17 years, said that he called me up and said he was resigning at the next election and he'd support me if I wanted to run for the pre-selection. So I went back to my wife and said, "Look, let's at least I'll give this a crack, and if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, at least I know I tried, and then I'd pursue something else." But why? I think politics is one of those great professions that you can actually, in a way, make a lasting difference.
Right.
And you obviously can do that in many professions, but I think one of the beauties of politics is that you can really make a difference at a small level and also at a major public policy level. And that's something that interested me, and it's been fortunate enough to have some luck and pursue this career.
So looking back on that time when you're first making that decision with your wife and that first sort of moment, were there things that you thought, oh, this is what could happen? So in other words, what I'm asking is, what surprised you about political life? So what's different? If you were talking to that Dominic back then, what advice would you give him?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I didn't think I'd win the pre-selection, so that's probably why we pursued it. I think, you know, politics can be tough, and you know, you go there, you come into it with being very idealistic, and it's hard to maintain that over time. So
I still think that's a universal experience, that everyone else is in politics has also come in with stars in their eyes and then, you know, sort of being ground down into a cynicism?
Yeah, great. I mean, I think a bit, but you find ways and opportunities to rise above it and to do things and to move. And, you know, I've, with a couple of the ministries that I've had, you know, always look for different ways of doing things and getting things done. But you can get frustrated with the process and the size of the bureaucracy to actually cut through and make a difference. It's almost like the government itself is the enemy that you're constantly trying to.
Right. Are you a fan of Yes Minister? The
program? Oh, it's so true. So if you asked, in terms of reflection, I loved watching Yes Minister when I was at university. It has become, now in hindsight, it is true in life. Like right. you have a much deeper appreciation of that series.
But possibly much less funny, I suspect.
Very much so.
Yes. All right. Now, in terms of coming into politics, and you said something about changing things, is there a temptation in politics to kind of set aside some of those starry ideals in order to achieve results? Because often, you know, short-term results, I mean, our election cycle means that every how many years you've got to front up and try to convince everyone to back you again, to produce results. The perception from outside seems to be that sometimes you have to set aside your ideals, some part of your ideals, to achieve some sort of short-term results to demonstrate you're getting somewhere.
I think it's true. I mean, it's the art of the possible, and right. We are in election cycles every 4 years. But it's also, unfortunately, I think what's happening in politics a lot, which is quite frustrating, is that you have governments and politicians focused on winning the next election rather than setting up the state and country for right. the next generation. And yes, that doesn't mean you're reckless, because you can't actually, make change if you're not in office. So in a substantial way. So it is the art of the possible. And I think early on in the term, you try and you can get away with a lot more early on and make the tough decisions that might be politically unpalatable, but set you up for that run into an election period where you're probably a little less frugal and a bit more conservative.
Mm. So let's get back to the faith issue. Mm. It's pretty well documented, I'd say, around the traps that you're a man of faith, and that you came in with some of the issues that you're looking at are influenced by that. Yep. And some people have criticised almost anybody who has a faith, and there was the famous criticism of Abbott and his conversations with hierarchy of the church and these sorts of things. Do you think that's a fair criticism, or do you think that, or how has your faith, if you like, influenced your public life?
Oh, I think it has an influence, and I think that Christian ethos is really is fundamental in terms of wanting to help others and improve people's lives, to love your neighbour, and I think that's very true. That's why when you go around the city at night, you see Christian mission and St. Vincent de Paul groups feeding the homeless. You don't see mm-hmm. many atheist groups running around doing that.
No, Fred Hollows Foundation, for example, does some pretty good stuff.
Yeah, and so there's balance, but I think the Christian, it's if you go back through even the Roman Empire, I was saying the other day that Christianity was doing very well because they weren't just helping people of Christian faith, they were helping people of all backgrounds.
Right.
And they tried to shut that down, and the state tried to set up their own their own missions in areas to mimic where the Christians were, and it completely failed because it didn't have that, I think, that Judeo-Christian basis that inspires people to not just improve their lives, but to help improve others. So I think it's in, I think having a Christian faith certainly, is it, does it inspire you to get into politics? Well, I think it's certainly part of who I am, and it inspires me to try and make a difference wherever I go.
Politics is supposed to be, you know, the idea of a representative government. People forget that the overwhelming majority of Australians still identify with faith. And so if your politicians are supposed to represent the public, then most Australians are Christian. Most Australians have a faith, or, you know, tick the box on the census. They say they're a faith. So the idea that somehow our politicians shouldn't share in that, to me, seems a little bit strange.
Yeah, and I think it's great that the parliaments have people from diverse backgrounds. That gives a great perspective to the various discussions and the debates that we have. I've never felt, despite, you know, you get the occasional commentators, I've never felt that people have, because I'm Catholic or I'm Christian, that people have judged that and said, you shouldn't be involved in public life. Certain people might have a prejudice in that space. That's a matter for them. But it's never really bothered me. I think back in the certain debates about separation of church and state, well, that was set up to actually protect the church. And I think if you look at some of the issues now that are going on in public life and in other jurisdictions, you can see why there was that ideal of the separation of church and state, because it's the state now intruding on the church rather than the other way around.
The church and state thing, sorry, I'm a scripture scholar, so it goes back to the whole establishment of a kingdom in Israel. And the idea of church and state was to both ensure that the king didn't dominate the religious thing, so he couldn't be king and God. So in other words, to keep him out of that sphere. But it also meant that it left the religious element to hold him to account and be his conscience, if you like, without ever trying to take over. So when Nathan calls King David to account for his abominable behavior to one of his subjects, Nathan doesn't then become king. He just steps away once David is held to account, kind of thing. So that's an interesting relationship in that respect. We've had some fairly aggressive debates recently, and it seemed from outside that some people were attempting to kind of line up the members of parliament who had some kind of faith and, you know, put them on the spot with debates in regards to abortion and some, I don't know if we've talked about euthanasia in New South Wales yet. It would be coming if it hasn't already.
Yeah.
And the more recent ones on prayer in parliament, these sorts of things seem to be set up to kind of, to if you like, give you enough rope to hang yourself. Yeah. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, those, I thought at the time there was certainly pressure. I mean, people would naturally know my views on those issues. And I think this is politics, so people will always use issues to play politics. But, you know, that's a pretty poor way of behaving, because these are pretty grave areas on whatever side of the political argument you sit on. Those issues really should be above politics,
right?
In my view, and I think in the main, the debate in the parliament was held in a very respectful way, obviously it was I thought it was a very disappointing outcome on the abortion
on that particular bill.
And there have been other bills in the past that I think they're also not so positive outcomes, but. But I've always felt, at least in the parliament, the debate has been held with respect, and that goes on both sides. And you know, I as well, you know, through that period of time, look at the other perspective and how someone from the other side would take their view how their life's journeys put them to a position where they would vote a different way than I would.
Mm. Some, you've mentioned that the abortion thing should not be used in party politics, or it's so important an issue that it shouldn't be used to play off in sort of personal politics. Are there things that have become personal politics that you might not think that you think they're fair game?
Look, I think there's always, I mean, politics comes into, I guess, the majority of issues.
Right.
Sometimes you get into, it's hard sometimes to take the party line when you disagree. That's kind of a part of our system and structure, is that we have whilst in our party we have a conscience vote on issues which are deemed to be of a moral a moral issue, but we have areas of cabinet, of party room, where people are able to express their difference on the party line or the government's position, but then you go in and support it. Now, I think there's weaknesses to that, but there's also strengths to it. If you look at the American position in terms of the slowness of government, given everybody can be lobbied in their own right, it can take a lot longer to actually achieve things. So unless it's something so fundamental, but I find that challenging at times. But you know, I also enjoy. I mean, I'm in politics. I enjoy political debate. I enjoy taking on the philosophical differences between our side of politics and the other side.
Mm.
But you know, then you have debates like the abortion debate, and personally, I found it challenging. I found it difficult, and because you know, you're part of a government and a parliament that's passed a bill that I fundamentally disagreed with and had some strong concerns on, particularly in areas where, you know, in its opening, you know, in the opening legislation before it was amended, did not provide doctors with the right for it to have a conscientious objection.
And
you talk about impinging on people's freedoms. That's fundamental. The fact that there was no care or support given to a baby born alive. You don't need to be Christian to realize that if a baby is born alive from an abortion, that baby has rights.
Mm.
You know, I think on those issues, it was a difficult time because you fundamentally disagree with people on something like that. But you know, people have different views, and at the very least, we were able to achieve some amendments that I thought improved the bill.
Can we come back to the religious freedom one? Mon and I have sat in this very table and discussed religious freedom and come up with different ideas, but perhaps the recent push for scrapping the Lord's Prayer in Parliament is a sort of a way of entry to this.
Yep.
Mon, you have a bit of a different take on this than most people because you've published recently.
Well, I'm actually not really against scrapping it, to be perfectly honest. You know, with the exception of Dom and a few others, I doubt that there are many people who are actually in that moment praying the Lord's Prayer. Some of them will be reciting it. Some of them will be thinking about what they're having for dinner.
Mm. That sounds like me in church, by the way.
And while I would love for Parliament to begin with all of our representatives there gathered together, acknowledging that there is a power greater than themselves and, you know, asking for help from that higher power, I'm not entirely sure that that's what happens when they're standing around praying the Our Father.
So you're saying it's not genuine?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the same – so the plan or the proposal is to scrap the Our Father in the upper house. That's the proposal. But the same upper house that prayed the Lord's Prayer the morning that the abortion bill was passed then went and voted for the abortion bill. So I don't know. It's not like if you take that out of Parliament that the parliamentarians who do pray and who are going to be robbed of an opportunity for prayer. They're just going to do it at some other time.
There is a symbolism to it, though. I mean, I don't want to make it purely symbolism. There is a point of having a public prayer. What it's saying is there's some kind of unified position, which is, I think, what you're getting at there, that maybe that position doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's somewhat tokenistic. And
I've also read part of your take, so you want to have a go at this one?
Well, I mean, one way of looking at it is I've been in Parliament for 9 years, and I think on the first day I went to the opening of the Parliament in the morning and realised it wasn't compulsory, and I haven't been back for the start of Parliament for nine years. So, but I still think there's some historical aspect to it that is good, and I think, you know, we do the Our Father and we do the Welcome to Country as the day starts. That's the way it's always been. I think the issue with the people trying to get rid of the Lord's Prayer is that they are running an ideological agenda, and it's the symbolism which they would prefer, and to, I guess, remove any sense of Christianity from public life.
Mm.
And where is Christianity or a sense of Christianity very clear on the front line in the Parliament?
Right.
So you can see why the Greens are the ones pushing for it to be removed. They're certainly not pushing for other areas or other welcomes to be removed. It's just simply the one that relates to Christianity.
Right. I wonder about it. And people say, oh, you should keep religion out of politics. I think if your religion, it matters at all, then surely it should matter in the moments when we're making the big decisions about other human beings and how we regard other human beings. people seem to be confusing the whole idea of a sort of imposing a ritualistic habit on everybody, or what religion, when we talk about religion politics, what we really mean is how we view other human beings and what we want to do for them.
And look, in the vast majority of the parliament, would people would identify with a Christian faith?
Okay.
I would think. Now, maybe not so much in political parties like the Greens, but they're a minority party. I think in the main, most people would identify as Christians. It's part of our Judeo-Christian tradition here. That's what's set up. And this is the whole issue at the moment, this new year zero type of mentality that Christianity is a backward religion that has no place in modern society. Well, it's a Judeo-Christian ethos that set up the Western civilization for the success that we've seen today. That set up the schools, that set up the hospices, that set up the universities. So if we're going to understand where we're going as a state, as a country, it's also important we have an appreciation of where we've come from.
So can I test this out a little bit more? I think that public debate has become a lot more polarized. And because Christians are perceived to be on one side of the debate, the perception is that anyone claiming to have an active Christian faith gets pushed further and further right. So in every article I read, I did a little bit of research, and every article I read you described as, you know, right-wing, right of the right sort of thing. And they describe people who I would think of as left-wing as, oh, they're moderates, you know. So everyone who's on my side, and I've noticed the commentary from the other side is the same. Anyone I agree with is called a moderate, and everyone else is, you know, wings from there. But what I'm interested in is that Christianity is actually for the oppressed. Like the preferential option for the poor and the care of the poor comes from the Judeo-Christian ethic. Yeah. If I can throw one particular line that came out in your first, I'm going to confess something personal here. In your first budget, I always watch the budgets. Now I'm a bit of a weirdo that way. But
they're very important.
Well, I watched the first budget and I said, this is the first time I've been interested in Liberal Party for a long time. Now, people might call me a conservative, but I'm a bit radical in my economics because I don't think that the free market is doing us favours in some respects. One of the commentators described it as you'd pulled the rug out from under the opposition because you'd delivered a Labor budget from a Liberal platform. And I'd ask you to comment on that. But I think what they meant was that you'd focused on health and education and families, and they felt, oh, this isn't Liberal. This is, you know, it's in the property of Labor.
Yeah, well, I mean, Labor don't have a monopoly on compassion. And whilst people might, you know, on their party might think that they do, I believe that, strong financial management and social outcomes are two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. And the problem with the Liberal Party has been that it's focused on the finances and the economics as if that's an end to itself.
Right.
We talk about billions of dollars here and, you know, GDP and all these terms that really make no sense to the average person, whereas our friends in the Labor Party don't talk about any of that. They talk about people. They talk about the outcome.
And they've been reasonably successful in putting across that message.
Yeah, but and that's why, you know, I'm always fond of saying in the parliament that we're the party of the worker, which rolls them up. But it's in my view, it's true because we've got more people in work, and if you have a strong economy and you have strong financial management, you can improve people's lives, and that's certainly what I'm focused on as a member of the parliament. Yes, with a liberal philosophy, but I know that we can do more and help people. And so when people, I don't believe it was a, if it was a Labor budget, if it was a Labor budget, it'd be in deficit and we wouldn't be helping anyone.
Well, one of the quotes that I saw come back at that particular article was, we need to stop measuring our success based on how well the rich are doing.
Yep.
And something that, if you like, again, this is a perception thing, not necessarily statistics. People don't tend to have the patience to get into the statistics, so the perception becomes the reality when they come to the polling booth.
Yeah.
But the perception seems to be that the Liberals are very keen on pointing to economic success, but if the guy who's out of work in the suburbs is not interested in how well this millionaire is doing, he's interested in whether he can get a job.
Yeah.
What I was seeing in the budget when I was listening to it, and what made me interested is that not that you, I thought it was a particularly Labor budget, but that it seemed to just simply be grabbing ideas, regardless of where they were from, and saying this one might actually work.
Well, that's right. And that's why you've got to be open-minded as a politician and look outside the box. And I've got very good friends in the Labor Party and very good friends who run what would be seen to be centre-left think tanks who float ideas that have merit and should be looked at. You can't be ideologically blind to your, you know, political philosophy or ideas that come from that. And, you know, you said earlier about getting labelled. Well, it's not, you know, people will always make labels up. You're right. You're right. Sorry. It's not left and right. It's moderate and extreme.
Right.
When it comes to labeling, but I prefer to be judged on what I say and what I do than somebody who takes a certain political bent and wants to label you. Labels can be powerful, but if you are somebody who's outspoken and get involved in the public debate on a whole range of issues, then I don't think you can be pigeonholed.
Yeah.
And I didn't get into politics to be a conservative crusader.
A pinup boy.
Well, and you know, you've always got your conservative fan base, but who are generally more disappointed with me than...
Yeah, I was going to say, because honestly, in my experience, as soon as I've stepped up to do anything, I'm usually getting, and as we said, I think before we went on air, the day in which I get accused of being left and right is probably a good day.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned left-wing think tanks. If I can throw at you that there's some right-wing groups that are quite happy to throw criticisms at you as well.
Yeah.
And they have done so. Yeah. And sometimes not quite rationally at the left-wing. You know, they're throwing arguments at the left-wing. Even if I think certain people are wrong, throwing irrational arguments and prejudicial arguments at them doesn't help anybody.
Yeah, but you don't get much positive feedback in politics. you get you get a lot more negative feedback, and over time you just kind of get used to it. I mean, I remember when I was first elected in 2011, and there was an article like a few weeks in the local paper that was like, and I was so concerned about it. Like, you get to a point now you just don't care. Not that you're reckless in that view. It's always good to listen to what people are saying and take their perspectives on board. If you believe that you're doing the right thing, from my perspective, if someone's calling it a Labor budget, that's an assessment for them to make. But if that's because it's based on people and help and trying to improve people's lives, I don't think that the Labor Party should have a monopoly on that.
Right.
If a budget is focused on people, focused on providing better healthcare, focused on giving greater support for families who need it. If people say that's a Labor budget, that shows that we've kind of fundamentally failed in the branding of our party.
Right. It's a branding issue, but it's still, I mean, in practice, I mean, I grew up in my father was very ill. Sickness benefits kept us on. If it hadn't have been for the way the government structured, I wouldn't have had the end of my high school education, let alone university degrees. I'm now in my fifth degree, and this is all possible now. I'm paying my own way, but that's only possible because of a leg up that I had. Yep. Providing opportunity to people has been kind of at least the political perception has been that it's been on one side of politics. So I'm glad to see it perhaps evening out a little. But I want to come back to the personal side of it. You've clearly developed a little bit of a thick skin with your perception. What about family? I mean, the family now have to kind of endure the reflected or the sort of the residual shrapnel from all of this. How are they going?
Yeah, going really well. We just had our sixth baby.
Wow. Congratulations.
Beatrice, yeah, thank you. So, look, it's having a young family in politics can be tough because it's hard to balance work and family life, and I am certainly not getting high distinctions in that, but I'm improving and always looking at new ways of doing things, and we work hard at that. It's probably an advantage having younger kids because they're less understanding of what's going on in politics at the time. I would think it'd be harder if you had teenage kids, older kids who would then, you know, their father or their mother's getting smashed up in the paper. That probably leads to some certain issues at school. And I know a number of cases where that's occurred. So having young kids is a different challenge, and just, you know, constantly fighting for time to make sure that this might not sound great, But you know, you've got to kind of schedule family time into your diary.
Right.
It doesn't just happen organically. And we find ways, Helen and I, my wife and I, find ways of doing it. You know, every Monday night, for example, is our date night. We go out to dinner and it's locked in. And it doesn't, nothing can, I mean, it'd have to be a pretty massive event for that to change and for that night not to go ahead. And that's been fundamental. And we try and do it, I try and do a dinner with the kids once a week as well, and clear weekends as much as possible. But that means you say you get called on a day, sometimes a left wing, sometimes a right wing. In terms of criticism, you're never going to make everybody happy in politics. And when you're balancing the needs of, you know, your constituency, stakeholders, other ministers, the premier, and then your wife and your kids, you've got to make sure that your wife and your kids aren't last,
right,
in that mix. And I think early on in my career that probably happened, because you can sit there and think that, well, your family's always going to be there,
right.
And so you know, someone having a crack at you here, or you've got an important meeting here, or you've got a parliament issue that's coming up, it can be hard to balance all of those things. So that's certainly a challenge. Like, if you talk about challenges over, you know, going back to when I was young and 28 getting into politics, what I didn't foresee was that how challenging that would be. Mind you, didn't have six kids then, but how challenging that work-life balance would be, and the need to constantly look at ways of improving it. And that's something that I try and do.
What about for the ladies in parliament? Do you think it's the same struggle for them, or is it still just a little bit of residual difference in the way, say, a woman with a family of the size that you're talking about, would she have same issues, or would it be slightly harder for her, do you think?
Oh, I think they're all challenging. I mean, in a modern world now, you've got it's really, really difficult, I think, with the pressures that young mums and dads face in balancing work and family life. And you take your kids, even when you go to mass, you take your kids to mass, and the kids might scream and, you know, people are tutting at you, you know, it's like, well, you know, settle down.
If your kids scream in mass, we might just think, oh, you're just like the rest of us. We're not going to judge you for that.
No. It's a lot harder now in my view, given that the pressure of work and the 24-hour cycle of expectation that, you know, with emails, with mobile phones. I mean, I look back at those days. You know, I love walking through the corridors of Parliament and seeing all those old photos and think that was the time to be. Yeah, they're sitting in there smoking cigars, and there's no phones, and there's no
ventilation,
no Twitter,
in the room,
no
while
Facebook.
They're smoking.
Yeah.
You could say heaps of stuff and no one would have known. No one would ever know.
Yeah, say whatever you wanted.
Well, that brings us to the other thing, the transparency argument versus the privacy argument. There's some, like, times when you actually have to have a healthy debate, like in the cabinet room or something, where you have to have a healthy debate where you get to say things without fear of every sentence being analysed by the press or something like that.
Oh, and it's really challenging, because I find the press is very interested in creating division.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the moment, we're having a debate about tax reform, and it's frustrating because the way that the press interpret what I'm saying is pitched in a way that I'm having a crack at Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg.
Sure.
It's like, no, I'm actually just trying to have a constructive discussion.
Do you think they're about division or just selling more clicks? Because it seems to me they'll grab anything, even if it's positive or negative, they'll just throw it, because if it's going to get attention, though.
Well, there's an article today on, I'm talking about tax reform. I haven't mentioned the GST once, but the headline of the article is that we should be increasing the GST.
It's right.
Like, I didn't even mention the word GST in the entire article.
I think your
article.
Position is, if I read correctly, is that just increasing taxes isn't going to solve the problem.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But anyway, so in terms of it's a balance. But then transparency and openness, you want it. For example, you don't want to have your best decisions will get made if there's constructive discussion,
mm-hmm.
sometimes passionate discussion, as long as people walk out of that room agreeing that this is the position, and whilst I might disagree with it, I'm going to support it. And then there's the issue of transparency and balance with about family life.
Mm.
There's an element of displaying to the public who you are, whilst at the same time preserving your family's privacy that can be difficult. So it's a fine line there.
Speaking of perception, the Victorian Treasurer, is he still a Victorian Treasurer? Pallas?
Tim Pallas, yeah.
Yep. He he's from the Labor Party, isn't he? So he made, threw out this line, which has been on headlines everywhere, that you and he are the John Lennon and Paul McCartney of Australian politics. This kind of idea of you being in the same band, which was an interesting image because those two didn't have the most amazing relationship, but they sang some songs together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, the reality is, I mean, he's the Treasurer of Victoria and we would agree on more than we disagree on. Because the constituents that we represent have a lot more in common, and I have, I guess, more in common with him in my role than I have with Josh Frydenberg in his role. So it cuts across political lines, and that's you asked earlier about political debate. Well, you can get in the trench and just attack the Labor Party for the sake of it, or you can actually sit there and go, well, hold on, how can we work across party lines to make changes that are going to set up our state and country for success? So I'm focused on the practical and working with whoever to achieve some good for the state.
So would you say that, I should ask this, have there been members of the party or other commentators saying, getting really nervous? I certainly noticed some commentary, getting very nervous, hang on, they didn't take any notice for details. They were just saying, wait, hang on, a Liberal Party person agrees with a Labor Party person? What's going on? Has the world gone mad?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more, people are more used to a partisan approach to politics. But that's why I think reform generally since the Hawke Keating and then I think the GST has died, not just here but around the world, because with the 24-hour news cycle with Twitter and Facebook, it's so easy for oppositions to just be the party, whether it's Liberal or Labor, the party of protest.
Right.
Because if someone's trying to do a substantial reform, it's clearly going to be challenging, and it's very, very easy to poke holes in it and to throw stones. And
they don't have to come through with their promises if they say, "Oh, we would do it this way."
Yeah, correct. In fact, a lot of them would like to get the benefit of the reform and then come in and go, "Well, thanks for doing that. Now you got the reform through, but." We're in government, so it's a challenging space. But there are more opportunities to work across political divides. The reality is, the Victorian Labor Party has no influence in New South Wales.
Right.
But if we can work together to set up a national conversation that you've got both sides of politics believing something to be the right thing to do, I'd say we should have more of that.
What about if the young person, a Catholic or otherwise, a person of faith or a person just really passionate about something, wants to get into politics and they've heard, politics, all the ideals go out the window and you end up just in the grind of the machine. What's your advice to that person?
Well, they shouldn't lose heart. I think you can get frustrated in politics, but you can still achieve a lot of good. And if people don't step onto the battlefield when it comes to ideas, then I think society will be poorer for it. We want good people to still be attracted to public service as a vocation to make a real difference. And, there's that old saying that for evil to prosper, it's for good men to do nothing. And I think that's as true today as it ever was, before. So it can be tough, but a whole lot of jobs are tough too. And I think whilst it can be tough, it can be also incredibly rewarding at times when you've been part of some good decision making, and it's not about getting the credit for it. As you say, I probably get attacked more from conservative groups. but a lot of the work that you do in politics is not seen by the public. A lot of the good that you do, even at an electoral level, that makes a small difference to people's lives, people don't see that. So it's personally rewarding to be getting in there and to being in a position where you can influence and make a difference. To be involved in a discussion in cabinet that's never made public, but that you've helped influence a policy for the good.
So one last shot then. Those people out there who perhaps don't feel that they have a life in politics or are otherwise engaged, there's still a certain cynicism about whether politicians listen to us. So there's lots of times when we're presented with with petitions or, write to this politician, call them up or something. What would you say in terms of respectfully informing our local member or our House of Reps person something that we care about? What's the best way to go about that?
Well, I think sending them an email and arranging a time to meet with them to put your view. I think that most politicians certainly read and consider the feedback from their constituencies. Now, as Burke said, you get into public life, you know, to make decisions, and you should listen to your constituents. You shouldn't divest your judgment to them.
Right.
That's certainly my view, but that doesn't mean you don't consider it. And you know, if you take a whole lot of, I mean, just recently, take the abortion bill. I received overwhelming correspondence on that. I think over 550 emails and correspondence. Majority of them were against the bill. But even if the majority of them were for the bill, I still would have opposed it. And I certainly made it clear to my constituents who encouraged me to support the bill as the reasons as to why I didn't. And I understood that they were coming at it from a certain angle. And I think that I think most people respect that view, that at least you've listened to their perspective.
Mm. I think in your case, there's never been any doubt where you were coming from in that particular point of view. You made it very clear where you stood.
But I'll give you another example. I mean, we have just recently built the Northwest Metro, which has been meant to have occurred for decades. And as a result of that, we took some buses offline. Now, the community didn't like that too much. And they wrote a number of letters and correspondence and called the office. And so I sat down with the transport minister, listened to those concerns, and I didn't get 100% of what I wanted and what the community wanted. But we made a substantial change and brought back a number of services that I think will make a difference to the local community. So, yes, I think I wouldn't have people who aren't getting into public life feel that politicians don't listen to them. I think they do. And I'd say what's more important than a petition or a form letter is a genuine letter.
Personal contact.
Personal contact.
Yeah.
That here is my unique view. It's very easy to sign a petition. It's the next level to sit down and put pen to paper and say, yeah, here's what I think. And I think the majority on all sides of politics do listen to the concerns of their constituents.
Hmm. Any parting comments, Mon, before we move on?
No, I'd like to ask if you could go back now and give the younger Dom one piece of advice, that conversation about whether or not you run for pre-selection, what it would be.
Whether I should do it?
Well, what piece of knowledge would you want to know then?
Oh, that it wasn't going to be easy, and to not be as frustrated when challenges arise. And I've always thought, you know, I always like just getting to the outcome. And sometimes you've got to accept that might not happen overnight and it might take time, but that's okay.
Hmm. Well, that's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast at our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can let us know what you liked, what you didn't like, who you'd like us to talk to, what about, at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au. Or you can continue the conversation by joining our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook or Discord chat. You can find all the links in the show notes at our website. Be sure to write us a review on iTunes. That helps us to spread the word. But before we go, it's time for shout-outs.
Well, I say hi to my wife, who's been a significant support for me. And one of the things I should have done at the start was have a date night from the very beginning. So that's what I would. That's one thing, Monica, that I would have locked in back in 2011. That we've established recently.
Excellent. Are you ready, Mon? Shout out.
Sure. I'm going to give a shout out to my nephew, Josh, and my niece, Gabby, who think I'm a little bit famous and who will totally think I'm famous because I'm sitting in a room with the Treasurer of New South Wales.
I'd like to shout out to my poor, long-suffering wife, who I've just taken on another role in addition to my full-time work and this podcast. And she's now wondering where that date night will come from. So we'll work it out. That I've had some encouragement from this podcast. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.